Hello, this is Beatrice Pavia with part one of the Pantograph of Friday, October 24th, 2025. We turn first to page one, where the main story is about business, headlined, A Different Experience. Kobe Ramen Pho and Poke to open in Bloomington next month. The next installment of Kobe Restaurants, Kobe Ramen Pho and Poke, is expected to open next month at 1505 North Veterans Parkway in Bloomington. Owners Eric and Minzy Chen have been working on decor and furniture for several weeks to transform the former Giordano's Pizza into their new restaurant. The new look will feature anime characters and statues in hopes of making customers feel like they're walking through the streets of Tokyo. A soft opening is tentatively planned for Sunday, November 9th, followed by a tentative grand opening on Tuesday, November 18th. The Chens also own Kobe Japanese Steakhouse at 401 North Veterans Parkway in Bloomington and Kobe Revolving Sushi, which they opened in December, at 1500 East Empire Street, Suite A1 in Bloomington. Like Kobe Revolving Sushi, Kobe Ramen will have a robot to help deliver the hot noodle bowls to tables. The restaurant will have in-person self-ordering systems and online ordering, with options including a kiosk near the restaurant entrance and QR codes on the tables. The restaurant will also have what the Chens call a beehive-looking table, with two booths on a lower level and two on the upper. There will be plenty of photo opportunities, too. We want to bring this concept here, and it's just special, and it's going to be very popular, Minzy Chen said. It's very exciting, you know, it's new. At Kobe Revolving Sushi, people can win prizes. It's very unique, and now with this, Kobe Ramen, people can come who want a different experience. The restaurant's concept and design are very popular in China, she added. Kobe Ramen will be serving nine different ramen flavors, as well as pho, which is Vietnamese soup noodles, mi shan, a Chinese rice noodle, poke bowls, and other traditional dishes. Boba drinks will be available, and so will rice plates with General Tso's chicken, Kobe Jung pork chop, black pepper garlic shrimp, or Kobe teriyaki steak. Appetizers will include spring and egg rolls, popcorn chicken, cheese wontons, chicken wings, fried oysters and scallops, pork gyoza, Vietnamese spring rolls, and vegetable tempura. With the addition of Kobe Ramen, the Chens will have three Bloomington restaurants under their belt, but they are not stopping there. They're already working on two additional projects, including a Korean fried chicken restaurant and a craft store. Patrons may have noticed that Ching's Chinese Restaurant at 1101 North Main Street in Normal closed earlier this month. However, Ching's owners, Olivia and Hong Lu, are partnering with the Chens to open Kobe Eon at their Main Street location, which they hope to open in April. This restaurant will offer Korean fried chicken, corn dogs, boba and boba waffles, a popular dish in Hong Kong made of egg waffles infused with boba pearls, and more. Little kids, they love it, the boba waffles, Minzy Chen said, adding that she also expects the restaurant to be popular with students at nearby Illinois State University. Additionally, the Chens plan to open Craftify DIY Studio near the end of this year or early next year. The store will be replacing The Massagist, the massage therapy business, at 401 North Veterans Parkway, Suite 6 in Bloomington. It is also next to the Chen's other restaurant, Kobe Japanese Steakhouse. It's very popular in China. A lot of kids doing these things, Minzy Chen said of the store. The craft store is going to be very good. A lot of kids don't have a lot of places to have their birthday parties besides the trampoline parks. Some kids want to sit down and do something else. She said they will have DIY glitter glue, also known as cream glue, which mimics the appearance of cake icing and is used to decorate party accessories like parking signs, card holders, music boxes, pencil cases, phone cases, mini mirrors, and more. First, though, the Chens said they want to make sure the ramen place is stable before they pick up speed on new projects. And our next front page story is headlined, Bailey Family Dies in Crash, GOP Candidate's Son's Wife and Two Kids in Helicopter Accident. This story is from the Chicago Tribune. The son of Republican candidate for governor Darren Bailey, along with two of Bailey's grandchildren and daughter-in-law, were killed in a helicopter crash in Montana, the former state senator's campaign announced early Thursday. On Wednesday evening, Darren and his wife Cindy received the heartbreaking news no parent ever wants to hear. Their son Zachary, his wife Kelsey, and their two young children, Vader Rose, age 12, and Samuel, age 7, tragically lost their lives in a helicopter accident in Montana, the campaign said on Facebook. The couple's third child was not on the helicopter. The accident comes just weeks after Bailey of Xenia in southern Illinois announced his plans to run for the GOP nomination for governor for the second time. Bailey was the Republican nominee for the office in 2022 before losing by about 13 percentage points to Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker. Bailey's Lieutenant Governor running mate, Aaron Del Mar, said the family was in Montana on a business trip so that Zachary Bailey could expand their use of helicopters as part of the family's farm business in South Central Illinois. Zachary Bailey first got his helicopter license years ago, Del Mar said, so that he could deliver medical supplies and aid to people in third world countries. That was a driving force for him to get his license, he said. The cause of the crash was not known, Del Mar said. The National Transportation Safety Board said Thursday it was investigating the crash near the town of Ekalaka. The sheriff's office in Carter County said it responded to the site southwest of the town early Wednesday evening. Darren and Cindy are heartbroken by this unimaginable loss, the Bailey campaign said on Facebook. They are finding comfort in their faith, their family, and the prayers of so many who love and care for them. The Baileys deeply appreciate the kindness and support they have received and ask for privacy as they grieve and hold their loved ones close during this difficult time. In a statement on X, Pritzker and his wife, M.K., offered their condolences to the Bailey family. M.K. and I are devastated to learn of the tragic passing of Darren and Cindy Bailey's son, Zachary, daughter-in-law Kelsey, and their two young children, Vader Rose and Samuel, the governor said. Our prayers and deep condolences are with the Baileys in this time of grief. May the memories of their loved ones be a blessing. This coming Monday marks the first day in Illinois of the week-long filing period for candidates running for governor and other offices to qualify for the top ballot position in their race. Del Mar said it is the campaign's intention to file its petitions, but he said he has not discussed those details with Bailey. We are concentrating on the family right now, Del Mar said. In a statement, the Illinois GOP said it's lifting up the Bailey family, their friends and community in prayer. Please join us in keeping the Bailey family in our thoughts and prayers during this unimaginable time, the state GOP said. And our next front page story is about housing, titled, Residents Say Hilltop Deal Not Enough, Dateline Bloomington. A recent settlement agreement reached with the owners of the Hilltop Mobile Home Park in Bloomington aims to reimburse overcharged residents and provide transparency about tenants' rights. However, some residents feel that more can be done by the property owners, as streetlights and other maintenance problems are still unresolved since the property was purchased in 2023. In June 2024, Hilltop residents Rose McWhorter and Stephen Evans filed a lawsuit against Oakwood Properties, which owns the Hilltop Park and several other mobile home communities, alleging multiple state statute violations. Oakwood Properties delivered a proposed lease agreement to McWhorter and Evans in early 2024. However, they allege the lease violated the Mobile Home Landlord and Tenant Rights Act. The proposed lease gave no more than 6 months' notice to tenants of a park closure instead of the statutory 12 months. Notice of any increase in rent was set at 30 days instead of the statutory 90 days. The lease would also establish a $125 dispossessory charge, a $300 charge per month per person for each person inhabiting a home who is not on the tenant contact information sheet, and an $18 per month charge for tenants who do not add the park as an interested party to a $100,000 minimum insurance liability policy. "Everything in this lease is Texas law, not Illinois law," said Becky Petta, president of the Hilltop Homeowners Association at Hilltop Mobile Home Park. As of Thursday morning, representatives of Oakwood Properties had not returned requests for comment. According to her affidavit, McWhorter, who has lived at the Hilltop Mobile Home Park with Evans since 2014, said that in November 2023, the two received notice that the rent would increase from $407 a month to $495 a month. Because of concerns over the terms of the lease and new proposed rules and regulations from Oakwood Properties, McWhorter said in her affidavit she would not sign the lease. However, this did not stop Oakwood Properties from imposing the $18 monthly indemnity waiver charge. Evans and McWhorter also paid the $88 rent increase in March and April of 2024. "I understand that I have rights as a tenant of a mobile home park in Illinois," McWhorter wrote. "The lease and rules proposed by Oakwood Properties ask me to waive some of those rights by agreeing to terms that are not in compliance with Illinois law." Under the terms of the settlement reached earlier this year, Oakwood Properties assumes no liability to the allegations but agrees to review accounts dating back to October 2023 and circulate notices to any residents who may be entitled to a refund. Refunds were to be circulated no later than August 23rd, according to Aaron Duncan, supervisory attorney of Prairie State Legal Services, who represented McWhorter and Evans. "This settlement may not have resolved all issues any tenant may be having with the park, but we are glad that we are able to reach an agreement for these plaintiffs," Duncan said. Although the suit was not a class action, the owners were required to provide an annual disclosure of tenant rights, including the provision that a tenant cannot be evicted if they fail to sign a new lease to residents across all five of their mobile home communities. This includes Alexander Estates, Grandview Estates, Hilltop Mobile Home Park, Maple Grove Estates, and North Meadow Village in Bloomington Normal. Annual disclosures will also inform tenants that signing a new lease or lease addendum is not a requirement to continue to reside in a park, and that they have automatically renewable leases on which they may choose to rely, including ones that predate Oakwood's ownership. Tenants should also be notified that they may only be charged fees and fines specifically itemized in their lease. Although the overcharges and transparency issues were resolved, Petta also alleges Oakwood Properties has failed to make any improvements to the community since taking charge. A wooden playground was built in the middle of the park, but it is rarely used and sits at the stop sign of a heavily traveled road. The park has not had overhead lights in over 2 years and does not have lights on the median of the road, she added. And our last front page story is the Cutting Board column, this time titled, "Cured Meats, Long and Salty History, and Talk of Delis." I often wonder how the first humans figured out that salting meat makes it stay good longer. Some elk or antelope somewhere must have died in the ocean or the Dead Sea and became so saturated with salt that the next bloke to come across it said in an ancient forgotten tongue, "Hey, that's pretty good." In all reality, a lot of people probably got sick from such discoveries, prehistoric botulism and all. But after millennia of experience, trial, error, and the occasional decimation of entire tribes, The humans of today can waltz into their local supermarket pretty much anywhere in the 48 contiguous Alaska or Hawaii and find cured meats from salamis, pepperonis, pizza fans, where are you, corned beefs, and hams galore. However, it was not always so in this country, and the phrase deli meat is actually relatively new to the English language, according to Ted Merwin, author of the book Pastrami on Rye, An Overstuffed History of the Jewish Deli. Inspired by Merwin's book and by chats with some of the fine folks over at Moses Montefiore Temple in Bloomington, I set out to find a brisket with which I could make multiple dishes, including the titular pastrami. Roll up your sleeves, friends, because this week on The Cutting Board, we are diving deep into the history of cured meats and how they shaped what we eat. Folks, I'm going to be honest, this meat journey has been a long time in the works. I cannot accurately express the length of time, the anguishing search, and the editorial justification it took to get here. People at the downtown Bloomington Farmers Market may have heard me in despair once when a brisket had been sold before I could get to it, but we persist, and here we are. When I lived in Chicago, I had ready access to true salt-of-the-earth delis, really, whenever I wanted. A quick Google search will bring up results like Steingold's of Chicago, JB's Deli, Schneider Deli, and Manny's Cafeteria and Delicatessen, among others. There are often heated debates about who makes the best corned beef or who's got the best bagels, where is the freshest lox, and who's got the best melt. Here in Bloomington, though, we don't have much of that. And Merwin explores this in his book about how the deli survived but also adapted with the birth of suburbia. The history of pastrami, according to Merwin, starts with Eurasia in places like modern-day Turkey and Romania. Horse riders would often tie slabs of tough meat underneath their saddles on long rides to tenderize the meat and salt it with the horse's sweat. I know, that sounds gross, but would you rather have that or the ocean elk? I'm taking the horse patty. Side note, I read somewhere once as a kid, this is where steak tartare and the original idea of a hamburger came from. Can't verify that. Merwin does not cite a date when this practice transferred to the Jewish culture, but those meats would evolve in the 18th century and influence the life and diet of Eastern Europe when Polish kings invited Jews to emigrate. Fast forward to the latter half of the 1800s when Jewish folks emigrated to New York City, bringing their food traditions with them. Interesting bit of cross-culturation here. It's widely thought that this is where we get corned beef and cabbage for St. Patrick's Day. I've never been to the Emerald Isle, but if my Irish cookbooks are to be believed, corned beef is actually a pork dish that's traditionally served on said feast day. Corned beef was introduced in New York when Irish immigrants bought the salty roast from their Jewish neighbors who emigrated from Eastern Europe. Merwin dives more into the birth, proliferation, and eventual slow downfall of the delicatessen in his book, and I highly recommend reading it. I ordered it through Bobsey Bay Books and received it in about a week. I have not finished reading it, but it is fascinating. However, a word of caution, there are no recipes in it. It would appear that these deli secrets are closely kept, but I shall find them. Longtime Bloomingtonians may remember that for nearly 60 years, Moses Montefiore Temple would host an annual food fair, a chance for folks in the community to get an experience of Jewish food without having to travel to the city. Unfortunately, after 2019, that went away due to the COVID-19 pandemic, said Rabbi Rebecca Dubow. In its heyday, they would make over 5,000 corned beef sandwiches in one day, Dubow said. The whole social hall had been taken over. Gigi Ehrlich, longtime congregant at MMT, was the chair for many food fairs. The fair started in 1962, 3 years after the temple moved into its current location at 102 Robin Hood Lane, with steaming pots of matzo ball soup and handmade desserts, Ehrlich said. After some years, the temple partnered with Vienna Beef out of Chicago, to buy, at one point, nearly 1,000 pounds of pre-sliced corned beef to make quarter-pound sandwiches, Ehrlich said. The process involved days of preparation, a refrigeration truck, and a lot of help from the community to form and make the sandwiches. They still served dessert and sold soups, but the draw was the sandwich, she said. Unfortunately, Moses Montefiore Food Fair's prospects of return are slim to none. But Ted Merwin is coming to town on Saturday, November 8th to speak about his book at the Temple, and Jason's Deli is providing sandwiches. The event, called Where Harry Met Sally, An Overstuffed History of the Jewish Deli, is open to the public. A small corned beef sandwich on rye bread with coleslaw and a kosher pickle will be offered, with vegetarian options also available. It takes place at 5:30 p.m. inside the Temple, with a cost of $25 per person. Seats are limited, and reservations should be made no later than November 4th. RSVPs can be made by emailing mmtemple1882@gmail.com or by calling 309-662-3182 when the Temple is open, noon to 5 p.m. on Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday. I've already booked two seats. Well, on to the pastrami. I have it curing in my fridge as I type this, and I would implore you to come back in 2 weeks to see how I make this sandwich, pastrami on rye, at home. I'll see you on the next one. And if you are a farmer or a producer and would like to talk with me for this column, call me at 309-820-3275 or email daniel.alkire@lee.net. And be sure to check back next time to find out what we're chopping up on the cutting board. Well, that does it for our front page stories, and we move now to some local and state news. This story's headline, Charges Say Man Assaulted Girl, Dateline Bloomington. A man from Schaumburg has been released from McLean County custody after prosecutors said he told police he had sexually assaulted a minor girl several years ago. Jayesh C. Patel, 52, is charged with 5 counts of predatory criminal sexual assault involving a victim younger than 13, Class X felonies, and 1 count of sexual exploitation of a child younger than 13, a Class 4 felony. He appeared in custody Wednesday before Judge Amy McFarland. Assistant State's Attorney Daniel Guido filed a petition to detain, arguing there are no conditions that could mitigate the risk Patel poses. According to the probable cause statement, a girl and her mother came to the Normal Police Department in April to report the girl had been sexually abused between 2015 and 2020. The girl told police the abuse began before she was 5. After learning at school about good touches and bad touches, the prosecutor said the girl realized Patel had assaulted her. She told her mother in March 2020, but Guido said the mother respected her daughter's wishes not to report the abuse to police until she was ready. When she learned of the abuse, the girl's mother ensured Patel no longer had access to her, Guido said. During an interview, the girl described several incidents of sexual abuse to the police. The abuse stopped about a week before lockdowns were implemented in Illinois in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Her mother and other family members confronted Patel, who acknowledged touching the girl, Guido said. The prosecutor said her family reported Patel shifted the blame onto the girl and her mother and said he had done nothing wrong, as he was only trying to educate the girl. In June, Normal Police found and interviewed Patel, who confirmed parts of the girl's disclosure. He told officers he had been teaching the girl about sex because of her curiosity, Guido said. The prosecutors played clips of Patel's interview in court during his detention hearing on Wednesday. In arguing for his detention, Guido said Patel's disregard and his deflection of blame spoke volumes to his inability to comply with conditions if released. Guido also said much of pretrial monitoring would rely on self-reporting, which he did not believe the defendant capable of doing. He's deflecting blame, and the thing he blames the most is the victim's curiosity, Guido said. Assistant Public Defender Stuart Wallace disagreed, calling Patel cooperative and cordial during his interview with Normal Police. Wallace additionally noted the defendant has no criminal history, has since moved from the area, has not been in contact with the girl since 2020, and has had no other allegations from other minor children. In making her ruling, McFarland said these crimes are serious, but case law has shown there are conditions that can mitigate the danger in cases like Patel's. McFarland ordered Patel be released with mandatory conditions as well as the discretionary conditions to not have contact with any minors, remain in Illinois, report to pretrial supervision, and complete a sex offender evaluation and treatment. And Patel is scheduled for arraignment on November 7th. And our next story is headline, Apartment Fire Displaces Five, Dateline Bloomington. Five Bloomington residents have been displaced after smoking materials sparked an apartment fire Wednesday evening, investigators said. According to a news release from the Bloomington Fire Department, fire crews responded at 7:58 p.m. to the 400 block of Douglas Street for a report of a structure fire. The responding battalion chief upgraded the alarm to bring in additional crews when dispatchers confirmed the fire was active. Crews arrived on scene within 4 minutes and found heavy fire conditions had extended into the attic of a house, which had been converted into two separate apartments. The firefighters used hand tools and thermal imaging to find and extinguish the fire in the attic, according to the release. Crews searched the apartments and found all residents had cleared the building. No injuries were reported. By 11:28 p.m., Bloomington Fire Chief cleared the scene. In total, more than 30 firefighters responded to the incident, and a recall off-duty personnel was initiated to maintain citywide emergency coverage. A total of four adults and one child were displaced by the fire, and the front apartment sustained significant fire damage. The rear apartment also experienced smoke and water damage as well. The affected residents, which included the four adults and child, are receiving assistance from the American Red Cross, the fire department said, and a damage estimate was not immediately available Thursday. Fire investigators determined it was caused by the careless disposal of smoking materials, according to the fire department. Improperly discarded smoking materials are a leading cause of residential fires, the department said, and the department advised residents who smoke to always use a deep, sturdy ashtray. Never discard cigarettes in potted plants, mulch, or directly into the trash. Ensure smoking materials are completely extinguished before disposal. And never smoke in bed or when drowsy. The fire department also noted renter's insurance can help residents to protect their belongings, including in the event of a fire. And a marker honors IAA history. The Illinois State Historical Society on Wednesday honored Country Financial and the Illinois Agricultural Association, also known as the Illinois Farm Bureau, with a historical marker on the north side of the parking lot of the IAA building at 1701 North Towanda Avenue in Bloomington. Both agencies applied for the marker to honor Country Financial's 100th anniversary. This is the first marker the Historical Society has placed at a centennial business. Since its relocation to the Twin Cities more than six decades ago, Country Financial has been an anchor of this community, McLean County Museum of History Executive Director Julie Emig said in a news release. Country and its employees have made lasting educational and cultural contributions that go beyond what can be measured in dollars and cents. And the text of the marker explains the two organizations' commitment to farmers and rural communities, as well as the history and growth of Country Financial into the company that it is today. And this has been Beatrice Pavia with part one of the Panagraph of Friday, October 24th, 2025. I look forward to reading part two with you next.